You are listening to 93.3 FM WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio. Coming up next, a show the NSA always loves to listen into, and stop tapping my phones. This is The Mike Cannon Show.
Warning. The views expressed on The Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this indie media radio show, do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's hosts.
Guess who's back again.
Mike Cannon.
This is my boomstick!
This could be dangerous. You should go back.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change.
And now it's time to play How Many Houses Do John and Cindy McCain Own? Is the answer 4, 7, 8, 9, or 10? For the answer, let's go straight to the man who wants to be leader of the free world, John McCain!
I'll have to have my staff get you the answer.
What? You don't know? You want to have your finger on the button and... Well, all right, I guess I'll have to give you the answer next time on How Many Houses Do John and Cindy McCain Own?
And now, the only radio commentator not addicted to illegal pain medication, nor Viagra, Mike Cannon.
Welcome to this week's fully independent, non-corporate radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. For over 3 years now, we've been bringing you alternative voices from around the country and the world. With news and information the six mega corporations that control 90% of all television, newsprint, and radio do not bring you. If you like your news chewed up, regurgitated, sanitized, and spoon-fed to you by the corporate handlers, then this is not the place for you. We got a full plate this week, so let's get into it. First, we'll be bringing you Eat the State, produced out of Seattle, with its great weekly news and review roundup. After that, we'll be bringing you shorter pieces called Media Minutes and Radio Spin. This week, we also got some funny two-minute segments from the folks at Onion Radio Network. And then, as always, we'll be ending this first hour with a piece I produced for Alternative Radio World Ether out there, This Week in Radical History. Most everything I bring you each week and each hour of my show can be found at the awesome website radioforall.net. Radio for All acts as a kind of clearinghouse for us not-for-profit alternative media producers. However, anyone can go to the site and download this stuff for free. That's radio, followed by the numeral 4, then all.net. Radioforall.net. So let's get into this roller coaster and enjoy this week's ride. Here's some humor from the Onion Radio Network.
Moving on. If you planned on following the presidential election in November, you might want to plug your ears. A big election spoiler is coming up. A minor software glitch at the Diebold Corporation today caused thousands of electronic voting machines to accidentally release the results of the 2008 presidential election months ahead of schedule. According to the group of military and corporate leaders that has chosen every American president since Eisenhower, Diebold's mistake marks the first time the nation's leader has been revealed prematurely.
I don't even know if I can enjoy the sham election now that I know who's going to win.
If you can't trust your shadowy overlords to keep a secret, what is the purpose, really, of voting in the public democracy?
I'm fine with it. I mean, he was going to get my meaningless vote anyway.
Despite the leak, all of the presidential candidates have so far said they'll continue their campaigns.
Hillary Clinton isn't about to give up just because she lost the election. She'll give up when she's supposed to, on Election Day. And she'll act surprised.
Joining us now to talk about the leaked results is Diebold PR spokesman Ernie Kenilworth. Mr. Kenilworth, this was quite a mistake.
And we at Diebold would like to formally apologize to all of our shadowy puppet masters. This will not happen again. Please have mercy on us.
Do you think that people will still even vote in this election?
We certainly hope they will. This country is based on the fantasy that the government is the voice of the people. Going through the motions of voting and keeping the kingmaker's dealing secret is central to our culture.
Why do we need electronic voting machines in the first place? They're just not as reliable as our cloaked masters, no matter how good the software gets.
Well, I understand people's concerns, but from now on, we at Diebold will see to it that we properly safeguard the illusion of democracy for all Americans.
Well, let's hope so. So, for those of us who will watch, what can we expect on election night?
Oh, the same great show that you have always seen. We will be pretending to count votes, and we will be running an ongoing total throughout the night.
But wouldn't it be possible for them to just choose a different president so that we'll still have that same great surprise?
No, I don't think so. However, that does not rule out the possibility for a staged assassination after the president has been placed in office.
Oh, I take it that's a hint.
You won't get anything else out of me today, Gina. I've already said too much.
All right. Well, thank you for being with us, Mr. Kenilworth. After the break, researchers say they have found a cure for awakeness.
Sit back, relax, breathe in. Slowly, there you go. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomchik with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning. Sounds like Jav left and took the music with him.
Well, that would explain why I couldn't find the
CD.
Leo Kottke CD that I was looking for. Mm-hmm. Seems to disappear now about every 2 months. Well, that moves us on then to national and some environmental news.
Yeah, this week a U.S. appeals court for the District of Columbia ruled against the Bush administration. And the Bush administration EPA has been trying to limit states' ability to monitor and enforce industrial emissions under the Clean Air Act. Sometime around 1990, the Congress had passed an amendment to the Clean Air Act that lets states issue permits and limit emissions from industrial polluters. And it gave states the right to set more stringent limits than the federal government had set. And so the Bush administration has been trying to overturn that. In 2006, the EPA issued a rule saying that that was no longer the case, that states would not be able to set limits and issue permits and could certainly not set limits that were more stringent than the federal government. Well, environmental groups took the EPA to court, and these environmental groups have won now in this U.S. appeals court. So that's a major victory for the environment and for environmental groups. And this comes in the same week that researchers presented the results of a study on air pollution. It seems that researchers may have found the missing link that explains why people who are non-smokers, people who don't smoke, are getting lung cancer in record numbers. What researchers have found is that free radicals that are produced in the combustion process, which they had previously thought existed only briefly and then disappeared in the atmosphere. Free radicals, by the way, can cause damage at the cellular level. Has been known for years that they do this. Researchers had thought in the past that the combustion process produces free radicals, but that the free radicals would dissolve and disappear very quickly in air. What they're finding now is that these free radicals don't disappear. They're actually very persistent in the atmosphere, and they cling to particulate matter. Well, this was a study that you think should have been done a lot earlier. Well, industry isn't necessarily interested in this. It has to be researchers outside of industry to do the study, and it takes a while to get the money and actually do studies when you don't have industry backing. In fact, not only have they found that free radicals attach themselves to particulate matter, but what they found is that the amount of free radicals in moderately polluted air can cause is about equal to the amount of free radicals you'd get if you smoked 300 cigarettes a day. So I think evidence is pointing to this as a major problem. And they're just talking about moderately polluted air. Of course, this isn't an endorsement for cigarette smoking, because cigarette smoke contains a lot of other toxins in addition to free radicals that cause severe lung damage and lung cancer. But here we're also finding that polluted air can cause lung cancer because of these free radicals. And this is something we should also keep in mind. In Seattle, because last weekend we violated the Clean Air Act with levels of pollution that we haven't seen since the mid-90s here in this area.
All right. Well, if you were on the fence about smoking before, you live in a major metropolitan area, I guess that could push you over. Moving on.
Well, even if you're not a smoker. Polluted air can push you over the edge into lung cancer territory. So we need to do something about it.
Yeah. Moving on, update this week on that salmonella outbreak that happened.
Yeah.
What was that, like months ago now?
Well, yeah, it started months ago and it's been ongoing and continuing up until just fairly recently when the FDA finally came out and said, well, gosh, folks, it wasn't tomatoes after all. We're pretty sure now that it was jalapenos.
After it wiped out pretty much the tomato industry.
Well, yeah, it caused something like $200 million worth of damage to the tomato industry. Put a lot of people out of business, I'm sure. But there's been some new news on the salmonella outbreak that sickened some 1,423 people in several states across the United States. Associated Press reporters did an analysis of records from the FDA, and they discovered that shipments of Mexican chili peppers are routinely turned away at the borders for various things, for things like containing filth, for having illegal pesticides in them. In one shipment, there was a poison mixed in with the chili peppers. And about 10% of the shipments that are turned away because they contain salmonella. In fact, since January, 88 separate shipments of chili peppers were turned away at the border for these reasons. The FDA, I should point out, inspects only about 1% of all foreign food that enters the country. And the FDA had only really been paying a lot of attention to dried chili peppers, excuse me, because dried chili peppers are often laid out in the sun in the open air in order to dry them out, and that's when they're often exposed to, you know, wildlife and other types of contamination that can put salmonella or E. coli, other things, in amongst the chili peppers. And they weren't really paying much attention to fresh chilies, even though fresh chilies are turned away from the border on a routine basis because they contain filth and other problems. So it was kind of interesting that even with the fact that the FDA is turning away so many shipments at the U.S.-Mexican border, no warning was given to the public that you should be careful, wash your chili peppers watch them closely. If they look like they've been contaminated, don't eat them. You know, no warning was given. There were no stepped-up inspections of shipments of chili peppers. And when the salmonella outbreak first occurred, the government wasted valuable time looking at tomatoes and didn't look at FDA records closely enough to figure out early enough what could have been the real cause. And while they were wasting that valuable time, many, many, many more people got sick from the salmonella bacteria. And I just want to point out, too, that every year some 76 million Americans get sick from foodborne illnesses, and about 5,000 people in the United States die from foodborne illnesses because the FDA doesn't inspect enough, because of industrial farming practices that are not safe and are not regulated by the USDA or the FDA or the Department of Agriculture. It's a shame. It's shocking. So we might ask, how is the FDA responding now that the Associated Press did this little analysis and revealed this problem? Well, the FDA this week issued a ruling on Thursday to allow the grocery industry to irradiate spinach and iceberg lettuce to kill salmonella and E. coli. Instead of doing more inspections, instead of asking for more money, instead of trying to put some decent regulation of the agricultural industry in place, the FDA says, no, we're just going to let grocers go ahead and nuke your food. There are major problems with this, aside from radiation exposure, particularly for children. To effectively kill pathogens in produce, they have to irradiate it so much that the produce suffers significant crispness and loss of crispness and nutritional quality. You could be getting your lettuce pre-cooked. In other words, in order to kill 99% of the bacteria. But what is more likely to happen is that groceries are going to mildly irradiate, not kill the bacteria sufficiently, and put the produce up for sale with the sticker saying, this has been effectively irradiated, you don't have to worry about it. So it's highly likely that this is an extra step that's going to be taken to pollute your food and not actually kill any measurable or any significant amount of the bacteria that causes foodborne illnesses.
You have to wonder if the grocery industry really wants to be doing this in the first place, just from the cost that they have to bear for it.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I can't see any benefit even for the grocery industry in doing this. I think the benefit really lies in people who want to revive the nuclear industry and want to bring about more nuclear power and the use of nuclear nuclear industry and the use of so many other places besides just in the uses of medicine, which is pretty much how we use it here in the United States.
All right. Moving on. Do you want to move to
international? Yes.
All right. Well, starting with Iraq.
Yeah, the U.S. and Iraq have drawn up a draft security deal. We don't know the details of it, of course, because here in the U.S. it is considered a secret. But apparently the Bush administration will accept a timeline after having said for years, no, we will not accept a timeline for troop withdrawal. Now, the current timeline appears to be June 30th, 2009, for U.S. troops to be pulled out of Iraqi cities, and then December 2011 to get them out of Iraq altogether. Of course, this draft agreement is going to have to be approved by the Iraqi cabinet and then by the Iraqi parliament. And as it turns out, there are already members of the Iraqi cabinet who have problems with the draft agreement and can't agree whether or not it's a good agreement. And the Bush administration won't be submitting this treaty to the U.S. Congress because in their eyes, we don't count. The U.S. public doesn't get a say, and the U.S. Congress doesn't get a say in approving treaties anymore. The members of the Iraqi cabinet, as I said, are already finding flaws. But it would be nice to know what it is that they're objecting to, but we can't know because this treaty is not only not going to be submitted to Congress, it's a secret treaty. And I have to just ask, what other evidence do we need here in the United States as proof that we live under a dictatorship, other than the fact that our government can go ahead and negotiate secret treaties with other governments that we never know the details of and are never allowed to comment on, and that our own representatives are not allowed to vote on?
Suicide bombings?
Yeah, just as the Bush administration is trying to declare victory in Iraq and bring about a close to the war in Iraq, I think it's worth mentioning that Al-Qaeda, even though they may have been mostly kicked out of Iraq, they've taken the war to other shores. And this week it was really apparent. You had major suicide bombings in several nations. This week in Pakistan, there were two major suicide bombings, where in the first one there were 30-plus people killed, and in the second one, 60-plus people were killed. In Afghanistan, suicide bombings are going on almost daily. And then again in Algeria, there were two more attacks where you had more than a total of more than 50 people killed and more than 70 people wounded. And in Algeria, where we hadn't been seeing many suicide bombings. Turkey, there was a suicide bombing this week. It's just incredible. Where we're seeing much less of this in Iraq, it's spread all over the Middle East now and probably going to go much further abroad.
All right. And developments this week in Pakistan.
In Pakistan, yeah. President Pervez Musharraf resigned rather than face impeachment. And this was something we could have expected because, of course, for Musharraf to go through the impeachment process would have further destabilized Pakistan. We're going to have to see now, though, if the coalition government run by a combination of Nawaz Sharif, himself a former president, and Zardari, the husband of Benazir Bhutto, who's known as Mr. 10%. Zardari was proposed this week as the replacement for Musharraf. Well, that's not a great sign for Pakistani politics. Zardari is, as I said, Mr. 10%, is known for his corruption. He used to take a cut off of every deal that was done under his wife's former administration. We're going to just have to see if Sharif and Zardari can get along and what this means for Pakistani politics, if they're going to dissolve into this internal fighting that could just destroy the government once again. We'll just have to see.
All right. And developments in Bolivia.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. We haven't been hearing much in the Western press about what's going on in Bolivia. We do know that there was a referendum on August 10th, and this was a no confidence vote on Evo Morales, the nation's first indigenous leader. It was an effort by his opponents, mostly led by a few provincial governors who are against his government and against sharing the resource-rich wealth of their own provinces with the rest of the nation, and particularly against his movement for land reform. They brought about this no-confidence vote against Morales. Morales won the vote by a fantastic two-thirds majority, essentially an overwhelming majority, showing that that he has nearly 100% support of the poor people and the indigenous people of Bolivia. And at the same time as this no-confidence vote was occurring, there were votes on the terms of these provincial governors, two of which were voted out of office, and two of those governors have simply refused to leave office, even though the no-confidence vote was brought about by them. They essentially said, well, we want this no-confidence vote, and in the no-confidence vote, they were voted out of office. Now they're refusing to accept the results. Well, the media coverage here has been focusing largely on the general strikes that are going on in those provinces run by the opposition governors. They haven't focused at all on the fact that Morales won the referendum by such a wide margin, and they haven't focused at all on the fact, in fact, it's often mentioned in Western media, that the provincial governors won their races by a wide majority, and that they're trying to oust Morales. It's often shown, these articles are printed from the perspective of the opposition government, clearly reprinting their own propaganda and not mentioning at all that two of those governors were voted out of office but have refused to leave and are essentially trying to undermine the democratic process in Bolivia. That's something that I think should be pointed out and hammered on, because the Western press is really falling down on the job.
All right. So that pretty much wraps up international, and we move on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, Mike was just talking to me before we went on the air. I asked him, what economic news has kind of puzzled you this in the last week or two? And he kind of scratched his head and he said, well, these bank things with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and everything falling apart. I just want to know, when's it really going to fall apart? And I have to say, Mike, that that's pretty much the question that other economists are asking right now. Things appear to be falling apart. When are they really going to fall apart? You know, with the market going up and down and stock prices for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and all these other companies going up and down and up and down and up and down, you're wondering, when are things really going to fall apart? The answer to that is nobody really knows. But there are people out there making predictions, and one of those people this week was an ex-economist at the IMF, a man by the name of Kenneth Rogoff. And on Tuesday, he said that he expected a large U.S. bank collapse to happen sometime this year, sometime before the end of this year. And he was mainly thinking in terms of an investment bank, but you know, I think he was also looking at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and saying that could happen as well. Of course, in the case of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they wouldn't be allowed to collapse. They're so big and that if they collapsed, they would take down much of the rest of the market with them. So taxpayers would have to step in and do a major bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That's what's been an issue.
Didn't they just do that? Didn't they just
do that?
Yeah,
we just did that.
So they do it again.
But that was sort of a partial bailout. That was saying, we're going to extend a line of credit to you in case you need it. Well, it wasn't coming in and saying, well, okay, here we are. We're going to buy you out, et cetera. That's the major bailout that we're probably looking at down the line. And most people are probably scratching their heads saying, why? Why Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? And why now? Well, the truth is, as I've said before, we've got a wave of mortgages that are imploding. The first wave is actually going to come in three waves. The first wave we've crested is the subprime mortgage market. The second wave that's coming along are these Alt-A or Alternative A mortgages that were mortgages given to people who didn't have to prove their sources of income or whether they had any assets, primarily given to people who were real estate developers or getting in on the real estate development kick, people buying second and third houses to fix up and flip. Those are people who got Alt-A mortgages. That's the second wave that's starting to hit right now. And there's a third wave waiting in the wings of people with adjustable rate mortgages that's starting to appear on the horizon. People who and who had option mortgages as well, who took out these mortgages with low teaser rates that are going to start resetting. And there's a wave of those. It comes in sort of annual or semi-annual waves. The first wave of that is hitting now as well. But that's going to go for the next 2 or 3 years because those mortgages were written up through the middle of last year. It takes about 2 or 3 years for those rates to reset. So that's a wave that's going to hit through 2010, 2011. So that's why Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are in trouble because, as it turns out, they bought up a lot of those mortgages. And they still hold a lot of those on their books. And so, many people have said that about 40 to 50% of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's holdings are made up of these risky mortgages. So that's why they're in trouble. And that's why we're looking at a bailout of them down the road.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Dr. Susan Lin is a child psychotherapist who directs the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. Her work focuses on the need to protect children from the relentless onslaught of marketing and advertising.
Democracy thrives when there's a population of citizens who can think creatively, who can engage in critical thinking, who aren't totally blindsided and susceptible to hype.
Lynn's latest book, The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in a Commercialized World, draws on her 30 years of experience working with children. Lynn says that commercialized culture actually prevents children from playing and using their imaginations.
We've reached a point in society where nurturing creative play has actually become countercultural. And in large part, that's because it's a threat to corporate profits. Children who play creatively don't need as many of the things that corporations sell.
Children are bombarded with advertising for toys that are often linked to movies and TV shows. And toys now are often embedded with computer chips so that simply pressing a button makes the toy jump or dance or talk or sing.
But the toys are actually having more fun and engaged in more self-expression than the children are.
Lynn says that to raise healthy, creative, curious, thinking children, we need to give them the experience of conjuring something out of nothing. We need to provide them opportunities to truly interact with the world.
It's really important to remember that make-believe, that creative play, is absolutely essential to the health and well-being of children. It's the foundation of learning. It's key to school success. It's central to creativity and to the ability to make meaning of life.
She says parents need to take responsibility for making thoughtful choices about introducing children to the market-driven media at such young ages. But parents need help from educators, healthcare professionals, and mental health professionals as well. Lynn feels the public health community needs to take a stronger stance against advertising to children and start lobbying for better policies to keep marketers away from children's TV programs and develop parent education programs.
There is an obstacle to these organizations becoming more involved, and that is that many of them take funding from corporations or a partnership with corporations who have a vested interest in making sure that we don't have government policies.
For more information, go to commercialfreechildhood.org.
Earlier this year at the TED Conference, an annual invitation-only gathering of luminaries from the fields of technology, entertainment, and design, Alyssa Miller of Public Radio International gave a presentation about why the U.S. media is showing less of the world than ever before. She started off with statistics for the news coverage for February of 2007.
This was a month when North Korea agreed to dismantle its nuclear facilities. There was massive flooding in Indonesia. And in Paris, the IPCC released its study confirming man's impact on global warming. The U.S. accounted for 79% of total news coverage. And when we take out the U.S. and look at the remaining 21%, we see a lot of Iraq and little else. The combined coverage of Russia, China, and India, for example, reached just 1%. So why don't we hear more about the world? One reason is that news networks have reduced the number of their foreign bureaus by half. Aside from one person, ABC mini bureaus in Nairobi, New Delhi, and Mumbai, there are no network news bureaus in all of Africa, India, or South America, places that are home to more than 2 billion people. The reality is that covering Britney is cheaper. And this lack of global coverage is all the more disturbing when we see where people go for news. Last year, Pew and the Columbia J School analyzed the 14,000 stories that appeared on Google News' front page, and they in fact covered the same 24 news events. Similarly, a study in e-content showed that much of global news from U.S. news creators is recycled stories from the AP wire services and Reuters, and don't put things into a context that people can understand their connection to it. In recent years, Americans who say they closely follow global news most of the time grew to over 50%. The real question is this distorted worldview, what we want for Americans in our increasingly interconnected world.
To see the video of Alyssa Miller's presentation, go to TED.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
This is 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.
Welcome to the weekly Radio Spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Diane Farsetta.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. In our top spin, Britain's Advertising Standards Authority isn't buying Shell Oil's greenwash. The agency ruled that a Shell newspaper ad that repeatedly referred to the company's Canadian oil sands project as sustainable was misleading. Oil sands development produces about 3 times as many greenhouse gas emissions as conventional oil extraction. In its ruling, the British agency noted that Shell had not explained how it plans to deal with oil sands emissions. Shell agreed not to run the ad again. The ruling caused political shockwaves in the Canadian province of Alberta, where the oil sands are located. The local government is eager for oil sands revenue. Earlier this year, it launched a 3-year, $25 million PR campaign to promote Alberta and to counter what it calls misinformation about the oil sands.
What do New York Senator Chuck Schumer and former presidential candidate John Kerry have in common? They're both Democrats, and they've both been targeted by the public relations firm Creative Response Concepts. Creative Response Concepts, or CRC, helped promote the anti-Kerry group Swift Boat Veterans for Truth in 2004. Now CRC is working with former employees of the failed California IndyMac Bank. More than 50 former employees, mostly from the bank's mortgage practice, blame Schumer for the bank's failure. In June, Schumer went public with concerns about the IndyMac Bank. His comments helped fuel a run on the bank when more than $1 billion of deposits were withdrawn. The former IndyMac employees accused Senator Schumer of, quote, a malicious, politically motivated act, end quote. They asked California's Attorney General to bring charges against Schumer under a state law against spreading false and damaging statements about banks.
According to corporate-funded groups, union bosses are scheming to take away workers' rights.
That there isn't going to be any secret vote. Just sign these cards showing us who you like the best. My campaign committee will collect and count them.
Labor union bosses have a new scheme to do away with secret ballot elections. Find out more at unionfacts.com.
You sure about this?
That's from an ad by the Center for Union Facts, an anti-labor group run by lobbyist Rick Berman. The corporate front group recently launched a $30 million campaign against the Employee Free Choice Act. The bill, which has passed the House, would allow employees to signal their support for forming a union by signing a card. Corporations are nervous that the bill will become law if Democrats win the White House and more seats in the Senate this November. The Center for Union Facts is running ads in 8 states. Another corporate-backed group, the Coalition for a Democratic Workplace, is running similar ads in 2 states. Walmart also held meetings across the country, warning employees that election wins by Democrats would bring unions into the giant retailer. Workers' rights groups filed an elections complaint against Walmart, saying the meetings were illegal attempts to sway employees' votes.
The U.S. military is looking for a public relations firm to help it carry out information operations in Iraq. The contract is for up to 3 years and $300 million. An Army public affairs officer said the goal is to tell the Iraqi people, quote, what we're trying to do to help them, and what we're trying to do to prevent people from using these ruthless roadside bombs that blow up people in streets, in schools, and synagogues, end quote. Firms with previous Iraq experience, such as the Lincoln Group, Rendon Group, and MPRI, are most likely to win the sizable Pentagon contract.
And now it's time to play 6 Degrees of Spin and Fakin, our look at the connections between media manipulators. We just mentioned the Rendon Group. This secretive public relations firm has provided communications support for many U.S. military interventions, including in Iraq, Kosovo, Haiti, Colombia, and Zimbabwe. John Rendon once boasted that during the first Gulf War, it was his firm that shipped small U.S. flags to Kuwait and had local residents waving the flags as U.S. troops entered Kuwait City. Rendon also organized the Iraqi National Congress, the U.S.-funded group of Iraqi exiles headed by Ahmed Chalabi. Chalabi's group was a key part of the disinformation campaign about Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction.
That's this week's edition of the Weekly Radio Spin. For more information, visit the Center for Media and Democracy's website at www.prwatch.org.
You may know the entire internet has crashed. More now on our continuing coverage.
Welcome back. Details are still emerging tonight about this evening's top story. The government is still dealing with the repercussions of the fatal error message that appeared on millions of computer screens worldwide less than 2 hours ago. And just moments ago, FBI officials announced that they had traced the crash of the internet tonight to this man, Eric Tipton of Wallingford, Connecticut. Tipton said he had more than 35 windows open on his computer at the time of the crash. He had been downloading the Yola Tango discography from iTunes while streaming several YouTube videos, listening to an NPR broadcast, instant messaging his friends, checking 3 email accounts, talking on Skype, and playing online poker, all while installing the latest version of Firefox and updating his system software. When he opened a friend's MySpace profile, an animated GIF of the Peanuts character Linus dancing started to play, along with a MIDI version of Justin Timberlake's Sexy Back. Authorities believe it put too much strain on the internet, causing the global shutdown. Tipton defended himself in a letter he transmitted to us via an archaic telephone line-based network of low-quality printers. He said, the screen froze up and there was nothing I could do. I tried to force quit all the open applications, but nothing worked. Tipton then pulled the computer power cord from the wall and replugged it in. Although the internet did restart, Tipton found that all data had been lost. At an emergency press conference, White House Press Secretary Tony Snow admitted that the government does not have a backup of the internet, but had, quote, always meant to get around to making one. Snow added, they are so mad at themselves right now. Perhaps even harder hit was America's blogging community. Trillions of pages of commentary and diaries of daily minutia have been forever erased.
Suddenly my life just seems so boring. I feel like control-alt-deleting myself.
Nigeria was the first nation to report a full economic collapse from the internet crash. 94% of its gross national product came from internet ventures. Several American organizations have already stepped forward to provide aid during the crisis. The TV network ABC has begun 24-hour broadcasting of America's funniest home videos to fill the void left by YouTube.
And in major urban areas, volunteers are handing out emergency diet tips, celebrity gossip, and humorous poems about office life.
A meeting between a coalition of internet power players has been arranged for later tonight. The group includes Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, and Craig of Craigslist. When we return, one man's heroic struggle to pick up the pieces and rebuild his Flickr album.
Poor people gonna rise up and take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
This week in radical history for the week starting August 25th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and more radical info can be found in the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
Yes, I'm a nerd, and for all you Star Trek fans out there, ever wonder in the Voyager series where the term Marquis came from? You know, the underground group fighting against the Federation? Well, the Marquis were the French resistance group fighting the Nazi occupation during World War II. Many of the Marquis were Spanish anarchists who took control of Paris after the Nazis fled on August 25th, 1944. Also, on August 25th, 1950, President Harry Truman orders U.S. Army to seize all the nation's railroads to prevent the nationwide strike to happen. The railroads are not returned to their owners until 2 years later. However, of course, their profits were always returned to their owners. Also on that date in 1968, the Battle of Lincoln Park Democratic Convention in Chicago, with demonstrations and police riots. 10,000-plus demonstrators versus 11,000 Chicago police, 6,000 National Guard, and 7,500 U.S. Army troops, as well as 1,000 FBI, CIA, and Army Navy Intelligence Service agents participated. The world would see what democracy looks like as the government beats and tear gasses the protesters. Lastly, for August 25, 1985, the White House confirms that Ronald Reagan was an FBI informant with his own Secret Service number in Hollywood in the late 1940s while heading up the Screen Actors Guild. How many names do you think this Fink named while he's being paid to protect the actors he's in charge of? This Week in Radical History for August 26th, 1786, Shays' Rebellion, armed insurrection begins in western Massachusetts. Armed local farmers upset about the draconian debt laws that often put farmers in debtor's prison and the government taking their lands, host an uprising against the government. For months, they successfully stopped local courts from holding debtors' trials until the government raised its own army and put down the rebellion by force. More rebellion occurred on 1913 in Dublin, as the 1913 lockout in Dublin happens, when tram drivers left their cars in the middle of the road during a bourgeoisie horse show week. Workers around Dublin had horrid living conditions due to poor wages. 26,000 families lived in 5,000 tenement buildings, which gave rise to the highest infant mortality rate in Europe, among numerous other problems. The Dublin factories locked out the workers, who at the end were on the brink of starvation, destroying the union and hopes for higher wages and better living standards. Also on August 26, 1919, more labor unrest. United Mine Workers, UWM, organizer Fanny Sellins is gunned down by company-bought sheriffs during the Pennsylvania coal strikes. She had been a witness to the beating and death of a fellow union organizer. The newspaper report stated, "The mine official snatched a club and fell the woman to the ground. This was not on company ground, but just outside the fence. She rose and tried to drag herself. The official shouted, 'Kill that, blank.' Three shots were fired, each taking effect. She fell to the ground, and the official cried, 'Give her another!' One of the deputies, standing over the motionless and silent body, held his gun down and without averting his face, fired into the body that did not move. One of the deputies picked up the woman's hat, placed it on his head, danced and stepped, and said to the crowd, 'I'm Mrs. Sellins now.'" Lastly, for August 26, 1968, the National Student Association reports 221 major college protests against the Vietnam War held nationwide since January of that year. This Week in Radical History for August 27th, only got a couple items. 1927, thousands turn out in violent protest over the deaths of Sacco and Vanzetti in Paris after two U.S. courts find the two anarchists guilty of firebombing in a trial that would give kangaroos a bad name. Dozens of other protests erupt around the world. Also on August 27th, 1988, George Bush Sr. says that atheists should not be considered for U.S. citizenship. Lastly, in 1992, Catholic Church apologized to Indians for the Spanish conquest. Well, better late than never, I guess. A couple years ago, the Catholic Church also apologized for its involvement in support of the Nazis and the Holocaust. And, of course, a couple years ago, the Catholic Church also apologized for the molestation by their priests. How Christian of them. Perhaps George Sr. should have insisted that Catholics can't be considered for citizenship. This Week in Radical History for August 28, 1926, in Nicaragua, for the umpteenth time, Marines land at Blue Fields to protect American interests. On this date in 1927, Ashes to Ashes, as Sacco and Vanzetti funeral is held from the north end to Forest Hills Cemetery. The anarchists are cremated. In September, all Hollywood newsreels of Sacco and Vanzetti are ordered destroyed by William Hayes, Hollywood movie czar. Here is a brief report about Sacco and Vanzetti's memorial held last week in Boston.
Emperor Norton's Stationary Marching Band provided a contrary festive atmosphere to somber issues of immigrant rights, death penalty, state repression, and the memories of Sacco and Vanzetti.
Well, I'm out here to commemorate the 81st anniversary of the murder of two comrades, Sacco and Vanzetti, and to keep their memories alive. And if their memories are alive, they are.
Why do you think it's important to keep their memories alive?
Because what happened 81 years ago is happening today, all in our streets. Right today in Boston at the Caribbean Festival, where the cops are importing Irish police to conduct surveillance on the crowd goers because of the ICE raids in which our elected officials cooperate.
It was a motley crew of 50 to 60 dedicated anarchists that marched from Copley Square through the streets of downtown Boston to the North End. Red, anarchist, and black flags were waving in the breeze. A large banner of Sacco and Vanzetti led the march. This was the day, August 23rd, 2008, that marked the 81st anniversary of their execution.
I was just talking to a bunch of Italian tourists who were wondering, you know, why do we care about Sacco and Vanzetti? Why are we doing this for the Italians?
That was the question I was about to ask you. Why focusing on Sacco and Vanzetti?
Well, Sacco and Vanzetti are a really, really important part of anarchist history to begin with, but especially the history of revolutionaries in Boston. The Italian anarchist movement in this country was really strong at that time, and we're trying to bring back the anarchist movement to be what it once was, and then more. We want a revolution, so great.
Molly Alderstein of BAM. She also works with the Lucy Parsons Center and later addressed the rally at the North End.
An extremely important thing to remember today on the anniversary of their execution is that the case of Sacco and Vanzetti is not some past aberration of our criminal justice system. We can't just look back and remember and breathe a sigh of relief, because this is how our criminal justice system operates. If anything, it gets worse with time, if only because it has become so pervasive that it seems normal now. From 1956 to 1971, COINTELPRO used similar surveillance, disruption, and entrapment tactics on a number of movements, from civil rights groups and the Black Panther Party to socialist and anti-war groups. Currently, to name just a few examples, immigrants, minority communities, and environmental activists are being heavily targeted in the same way. Like in the time of Sacco and Vanzetti, the state uses war in order to scare the general population into submitting to whatever security measures that it deems necessary to protect itself. Then it was World War I, and now it's a stream of never-ending wars. The war on drugs, the war on crime, the war on terror. If we ever get out of Iraq, there's sure to be another country ripe for the occupation. Iran sure is looking like a good prospect for both of our leading presidential candidates. The media certainly doesn't help in making us so afraid of each other that we've submitted to living in a police state. We need to open our eyes and start taking control of our own lives, our own communities, our own media, and our own security. We need to realize that the news on the TV and in the papers is not our own, but a perverted, biased, and censored version of reality designed to keep us scared and in the dark, grasping tightly onto the state. A venomous barbed wire slicing into our hands and poisoning our minds. We can create our own media. There are already projects out there that you can plug into, or you can start your own. If we want to truly honor these fallen comrades, we must continue their work and the work of so many others who are now dead or imprisoned who dared to fight against the exploitation of the state. If we continue the struggle, Sacco and Vanzetti live!
Bells from the old North End church chimed as the anarchists held their rally across the street. This program was recorded, mixed, and edited by your announcer, Chuck Rosina, for the Boston Community Reporters Project. Thanks to Freeman C. for providing technical support, and thank you for listening.
Also on August 28, 1931, the Italian government requires university teachers to take a pledge of allegiance to fascism. Why bother? Of the 1,200, only a dozen teachers refuse, and they are fired. The moral and critical bankruptcy of the intellectuals at universities and their pathetic submission to the state power and will is, as always, demonstrated once again. Also on August 28, 1955, while visiting family in Mooney, Mississippi, African-American teenager Emmett Till is brutally murdered after speaking, quote, inappropriately, unquote, to a white woman. The questionable trial that follows and Mrs. Till's decision to display her son's mutilated remains during an open casket funeral helped to mobilize opposition to segregation in America. Lastly, on this date in 1968, Chicago FBI agents report Ginsburg chanted unintelligently poems in Grant Park. Unintelligible poem was William Blake's The Gray Monk. This Week in Radical History for August 29th, 1911. Ishii, the last Stone Age man in America, surrenders in Northern California. Of the 2,000 members of his tribe alive in 1864, only 15 were alive in 1865. The rest were killed by the whites. For a good book on Ishii, read Ishii in Two Worlds. Also on August 29th, 1968, Chicago police continued to brutally attack demonstrators, reporters, and bystanders at the Democratic National Convention. The whole world is watching. The official investigation later termed this a police riot. As of that date, 27,508 Americans had died in Vietnam since January 1st of 1961. In another land based on freedom on this date in 2000, the Australian government says it will restrict visits by UN human rights inspectors because of its criticism of the treatment of their Aborigines. Lastly, on this date 3 years ago, Hurricane Katrina hits the south, destroying much of New Orleans, where upwards of 50,000 mostly poor African Americans were unable to escape. At the end of this piece, I'll have a short montage of interviews I got while I was down in New Orleans right after Hurricane Katrina hit. This day in radical history for August 30th, this was caught on film in 1979. President Jimmy Carter, attacked by a rabbit on a canoe trip on April 20th in Plains, Georgia, finally makes the headlines. Those rascally rabbits. If you ever get a chance, try to view this footage as a Secret Service man tries to beat down this rabbit with an oar as it tries to jump in the boat with Jimmy Carter.
Where's the ordinary rabbit? That's the most foul, cruel, and bad-tempered rodent you ever set eyes on. Run away! Run away! Run away!
This Week in Radical History for August 31st, 1836, U.S. Marines again invade Peru to protect American interests.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
On this date in 1925, Haiti, U.S. Marines end 11-year occupation. The freedom-loving democracy dictatorship they leave in place continues to pillage and murder Haitians for another 60 years, ending what was once called the wealthiest country in the Western Hemisphere.
And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest. What may be difficult to accept is that there's nothing new about that. In fact, it's what we hire our Secretary of State and our Foreign Service to do for us. The myth is that since the First World War, we were ever able to conduct our foreign policy any other way. The United States is a superpower with enormous and divergent interests that it is committed to protect. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality. I'm Ted Koppel in New York.
Only two more items for 1958. Fidel Castro and Che Guevara and the ragtag rebel army begins to walk into the woods, and they will return and start the destruction of the U.S.-supported mafia-controlled dictatorship in Cuba. Lastly, in 1970, Philadelphia police raid offices of local Black Panther Party. Among those arrested were young teen Wesley Cook, later known as Mahmoud Al-Jamal. Mahmoud was a targeted victim of the FBI's infamous and corrupt COINTELPRO program and is now in death row after a highly prejudicial trial. One of his appeal judges, for example, is one of his original prosecutors. And justice for all. This has been This Week in Radical History, recorded at the Glee Glee Studios. Since this week is the third anniversary of Katrina, I'll be ending the show with a short montage of interviews from New Orleans I got while volunteering right after the storm hit. Lastly, I'd like to welcome another station airing this little weekly ditty. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas, an awesome radical internet radio show. Check them out sometime. That's Radio Free Kansas. Before ending, a little nod to Michael's 11-year-old son.
You have learned much, young one.
War's not Mr. Great.
Don't give up on Howard Zinn. Until next week's This Week in Radical History, as always and forever, I'm yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
As some of you may know, I went down to New Orleans recently and interviewed some residents and activists of that devastated area. To close my show today, I'll have this five-minute montage of those interviews.
We're not just down here for a couple months. We're working here to make this into a permanent clinic here in the community that's run by community members and controlled by community members. It's a long process, and folks want to help out. This is a place to do it.
Of all the problems of racism and classism that were existing down here before, what happened down here was a whole series of human rights violations against people of the Gulf Coast was perpetrated by the city, state, and federal governments in conjunction with many national and international-based relief organizations.
That lack of organization from the government and what they're kind of where they're falling through, what you've seen where they fall through at?
Well, from what I've seen, it seems to be very bureaucratic in terms of getting supplies to any of the relief centers. You have to bear to prove ID of residency, you need to prove that you're from the area, and most people have lost most of the paperwork since Katrina and Rita had hit, that they don't have the proper paperwork to provide to show that they're a resident, and without that, and you go to a federally run relief center, your chances of getting supplies are next to nothing.
It's a class war that's being waged down here, and that folks around the country have to remember that just because CNN or Fox News is saying, oh, all services are 100% open down here, that's a crock of shit. I mean, you walk around in a 10 square block area and you'll see that, half to two-thirds of the businesses still aren't open. And it's a matter of blatant lies being perpetrated against the people of New Orleans, saying, oh, they're all hunky-dory now with their whole neighborhoods that don't have power, that don't have water.
A friend of mine that works for Palestine Indy Media, that has been in Palestine for long periods of time, repeated visits, said that she felt like this was Palestine. Between the military checkpoints and the curfews that would change on a whim of the authorities, the curfews, you'd get a different answer whoever you asked, because there were no military, there were no police here, in some places for the first 3, 6 to 8 days, depending on what specific neighborhood and who you ask. There was none of that presence on the ground. And then as soon as the military was here, they were acting like the checkpoints were necessary to keep out looters. I was like, you missed the boat, you're too late, you're lying, you're hypocritical, you're just wrong.
It's really important that people get down here if they can. I mean, I know everyone's busy. I know everyone has a lot of things they need to do with their time. But this is a place where people are needed. I know that the Red Cross and the FEMA are saying they don't need more bodies. And the reason that they're saying that is because they don't want people coming down here. They don't want people to know what they're doing. They don't want people to see the atrocities that are being committed every day. They don't want people to see the damage. They don't want people to really realize the war that's being waged right now, the war for New Orleans that's being fought.
I spent a long time researching who the owners were. I come back down here, and I'm told one of the women who wasn't at our meetings had been intimidated to force to give over her key, and her and her 4 children were out on the street, and she was crying. And we can't get in contact with that woman. We wish we could. So here we've got these landlords that are going around the law and certainly going around what's right and bullying, intimidating, bluffing people out. They've already got construction crews over here, contractors, all these things. And they're telling 75-year-old women that they might get hit by trucks. It's just, veiled threats, and it's just unacceptable.
Around here, I look at an apartment, they say $1,000 for deposit, $1,000 for rent. I am a person clean house. The people not come back yet. I don't have enough money for pay that apartment's very expensive for me. I don't have place to go.
The need is still here, even in Algiers, where a lot of the community businesses aren't open, and it's 100 times fold that in huge swaths of this town, like in the 9th Ward, where almost nobody's back because there's no infrastructure set up there. So thanks again for all your efforts, and Common Ground's an awesome place, and I hope people get a chance to come down and check it out, and at least check out the website at commongroundrelief.org.